Hey everybody, it's Against Everyone with Connor Abib, a weekly podcast featuring my conversations with countercultural figures and presenting complex philosophical, spiritual, and political ideas in an engaging and accessible way, also with the mission of inspiring these kinds of conversations in your own life. I'm very excited to do an episode, surprisingly, you may think, on Aesop's fables against empires. And this episode is with the great Irish author Carlo Gabler. Carlo is the author of 30 books, or more, maybe. He is the son of the famed Irish writer Edna O'Brien, was named after Karl Marx, and has recently released a book called Aesop's Fables, The Cruelty of the Gods. So I just saw this book at a bookstore, and it was so alluring that I picked it up, and I was just in it immediately. It's a retelling of Aesop's Fables, with these great drawings by the artist Gavin Weston. And it sort of positions them in this kind of modern way, but without losing that flair of just talking animals and all that kind of weirdness. But what rose up out of these fables, aside from who Aesop is and why he told these stories in the first place, which is in the introduction, was really about the political condition that we're in now and how these fables create ways for us to look into it, create strategies for fighting it, and also just sort of see and assess the brutality of what we're up against. Also to indicate what forgiveness might mean in the cases when we're trying to construct a new world and we're dealing with people who have done monstrous things, and forgiveness of ourselves, or maybe re-examination of ourselves for our own monstrous desires and appetites. Anyway, it's a really great conversation. We go all over the place, and Carlo also reads a bunch of the fables in the book. There are 190 of them, but he just reads, I think, 5, including The Frogs Who Demanded a King, The Flute-Playing Wolf and the Dancing Kid, and then my favorite, The Fox and the Farmer. So this is the part of the intro where I tell you to please support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/ConnorHabib. This show is fully funded by grassroots donations of support, contributions to the mission of the show. So that's patreon.com/ConnorHabib. It's very easy. You can pause the show and do it right now from your phone. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib, and you get all kinds of cool stuff in return that is exclusive only to patrons. Also, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and give it a 5-star rating on iTunes if you do subscribe on iTunes. The visibility of the show is completely dependent on the ratings and the high ratings of the show. So the more those get, the more visible the show becomes. All right, that's it. Without further ado, here is, and I'm very excited to share it with you, my episode about Aesop, Aesop's Fables and Empire with Carlo Gabler. Hi, everybody. This is Against Everyone with Connor Abib, and I'm very excited to be here with Carlo Gabler. Hello.
Good afternoon.
And also with some people playing football in the background. So if you hear them, it's great. We're great ambiance, I guess.
And possibly a little bit of tennis.
And a little bit of tennis?
Yes. The thwack of the tennis ball might be heard.
Okay. Well, so I wanted to start actually with something. I saw you on the internet, in conversation with Will Self and John Banville about Dubliners.
Yes.
And you open the conversation very interestingly with this quote from Lenin, which is, whatever else it is, the production of art is always an economic act.
Yes.
Okay. And, now considering this book you have out on Aesop and Aesop's Fables, for Aesop, certainly it was an economic act, I would say, right? The act of, the transactional act of survival. I'll give you a story and you'll promote me. I'll give you a story and you'll let me live. It's almost like Shariar and, in 1001 Nights, right? And so I wanted to think about
the ways in which his work was transactional. So can we start and talk about that, and maybe we'll jump into one of his fables.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the Lenin quote came from my father. Mm-hmm. And I did try to find it once in the collected works. It is in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. I gave up. And I've always thought that this is something to remember. Whatever else it is, the production of art is always an economic act.
Mm-hmm.
The person who we know as Aesop, if he existed, he may have been an invention, though there may have been people like him. But let us assume there really was this figure. He was kind of... well, he was like LBJ in his younger days. He was like those political people in America who work behind the scenes to help politicians, or in the United Kingdom, Alistair Campbell. Politicians, demagogues, lawyers, bullies, tyrants, merchants, people would come to him and they would say, I have to appear in court. Please, you will appear on my behalf. You will tell a story and you will bring the case to a successful conclusion for me, or I need to win an election, etc., etc., etc. And you were paid for this. And he became, according to the account of the life of Aesop, which was written some hundreds of years, some centuries after his death, he became fairly wealthy.
So can I just jump in real quickly for the listener's sake? Because it's something that I noticed but is a little confusing to me. It's the concept of telling a story to solve a dispute. Bring a story about animals to solve a dispute, that sort of thing. How did that happen?
Well, he would have had this treasure trove of material, this cache. It's not known whether he was literate or not.
Yeah.
And people, you know, in those days, because they didn't have the internet and they used their brains, they could hold vast amounts of stuff in their head. Someone would approach him, and they would say, this is my problem. And he would take one of his stories, which with the structure, with characters and conceit, conflict, and then tweak it, alter it, reconfigure it, repurpose it to fit the circumstances in which he found us. So he would add, maybe he would add the names of the people in the court, or he would make a direct connection between the story and...
I see.
He was, and the story and the situation, he himself, when he was tried at the end, he visited Delphi, the oracle, a very important and numinous place in ancient Greece. He was an outspoken person. They were disgruntled by what he said. Valuables, silverware belonging to the oracle were placed in his luggage and then discovered as he left. To steal from the oracle was a terrible crime.
Mm-hmm.
He was put on trial, and he told the story in his defense of the mouse and the frog who tie themselves together so they never get separated on land.
Mm-hmm.
And then the frog dives into the bottom of the pond and pulls the frog down and drowns. And he said, that's what I am. Uh-huh. I am the mouse attached to you, the frog. I mean, you can read the introduction. It's much better put in the book. It didn't work. So they took him to a cliff and threw him off.
And subsequently?
Well, then they were affected by the economy, and the agricultural economy collapsed.
Uh-huh.
And the oracle told them that they had displaced the order of the universe by killing Aesop. So they had to build an enormous pyramidical mound stroke monument to this man outside the oracle.
I guess I'm wondering, like, what's going on, though? Like, so someone wants to resolve a dispute in front of some hierarchical figures, judges or kings, or I don't know what the words would be, you know. You know better than I at that time. But and then someone shows up and tells a story about frogs and mice and all that kind of stuff, and somehow it lends strength to the argument. So it's almost as if he's a sort of character witness for the culture that the person is trying to present in court.
He is a character witness,
yeah.
But he's also, we only have the stories. He would also be adding, no doubt, all sorts of other rhetorical material.
I see.
He might add songs, he might add references, he might, you know, make satirical comments about the other side, he might do all sorts of things. But actually, what he was doing is not a million miles away from what all advertising is doing now. And all political campaigning is doing now. They try to you know, make it less overtly narrativized, mm-hmm. but they have a story. Now we're not as good as people were in Aesop's day. We don't have, you know, talking camels and singing sheep, and I'd be much happier if we did. But we you know, all our persuasion, our texts of persuasion, in whatever form they come, films, videos, political broadcasts, etc., do have embedded in them a narrative, rather cruder than Aesop's kinds of narrative, but we use narrative to sell.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, there's that sort of that tried and true advice to writers, which is show, don't tell, right? And Aesop's thing is showing, but using more often than not, it seems like animals, right? So immediately the person that hears it is forced to enact the scene in their mind. They have to co-create it with him to imagine the talking animals and all that kind of stuff. And so it will leave an impression of some sort or another by, you know, showing these impossible stories that are meant to have, you know, some sort of lesson or
whatever. Absolutely.
Yeah.
He provokes the fancy, the imagination, you know, the capacity to make what doesn't exist exist.
Yeah.
In the listener or the reader's mind. So you see the wolf, you see Zeus, you see the donkey. And as soon as you create a picture and then you add sentences, because, of course, these people talk, and you add contextualization. It's hot, it's cold, it's raining, there is the clink of money, whatever, gold, the smell of wine. Then you have got something that stays rooted. It's much easier to get into the head with a picture and a scenario involving conflict than it is to get into the head with an argument. You should vote for me because I am a nice person and I will lower your taxes.
Right.
That, yeah? Okay, tell me something new. If you want to hold people's attention, once with the story you've got their attention, then they are much more likely to be susceptible to your political content or message.
Yeah, so just word to anybody who's campaigning in the 2020 election in the U.S., just talk about centipedes and hawks and mice instead of your policies. It might go over better for you.
Yes.
So, okay. So speaking of which, I would love if you read a fable, which you've entitled. I don't know if these are the original titles. But
more
the
or less. I changed the titles. Okay. I changed the morals.
The Clever Lamb and the Wolf.
The Clever Lamb and the Wolf. The wolf was following the course of the little stream running down the hillside, when he saw a lamb ahead. The little creature was by himself, his flock was nowhere to be seen, and he was balanced on the bank, his head down, quietly sucking water up with his long, narrow mouth. "I want you, little lamb," the wolf said to himself, "but as you're so young and small and inexperienced, I've got to come up with a reason to eat you. I can't take you just like that." This was typical of the thinking of this wolf, who believed it was essential to be ethical, just as long as all the decisions that he made regarding what was right and what was wrong were his. "So what can I come up with," continued the wolf, "as a reason to eat him?" He pondered for a moment. "Got it," he said, his eyes brightening and widening. The wolf sauntered up to his intended victim. "Hello, little one," he said. The wolf looked. "Hello, little one," he said. The lamb looked up. The wolf was so close, he knew at once there was no point trying to run. "I've got some bad news for you," said the wolf, "and I'm just going to give it to you straight. I have to eat you. You've muddied the waters, and that's what happens to animals who muddy waters. They get eaten. Simple as that." "What are you on about?" said the lamb, in his high, tiny voice. You've come from upstream, and it's a physical impossibility that I could have muddied the waters up there. Water flows down, not up. But even if you'd been below and come up, the water wouldn't have been muddy. When I drink, I suck quietly, and I don't stir the stream's waters when I do. The wolf nodded. All this, he had to admit, was true. Fine, you haven't muddied the water, said the wolf. I accept that. However, the fact remains you're a nasty piece of work. Last year, you said some vile things about my father. And, as we know, if you slander, you get eaten. That's the way it goes. I wasn't even born last year, said the little lamb. He was a quick-witted and nimble-tongued fellow. Oh, shut up, said the wolf. Whatever you say, in the hope of staying alive, I'm having you anyhow. He closed his jaw around the lamb's neck and bit down hard, snapping the creature's vertebrae and killing him instantly. The moral of the story is, there is no defense against the unscrupulous. I made one or two fluffs earlier, but just leave them in.
That's fine.
Leave the fluffs in. Give the audience the whole thing, fluff and all. It's official.
I will not unfluff you.
Do not unfluff.
I love that. And there's also one earlier in the book called The Cock and the Cat. The moral is, he who does evil never lacks for an excuse.
Yes.
Yes. And I think that, you know, something I see in a lot of your writing is that, you know, there's an idea of making sense of violence. How does this fit? Because there's no option to say it's not going to be here. It's here. So how do you fit it? How do you make sense of it? Is there a way to make sense of it? And I love this because it really says, like, you know, you may think you're going to escape violence by being sort of like Bugs Bunny and talking your way out of it like the clever lamb, or, you know, find some way to speak sense to the cat or the wolf, you know, who wants to eat you. But in fact, there actually just may not be that option sometimes. Mm. And that's something I think just comes up in your preoccupation and imagination to begin with. I don't know if you agree with that.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm a deep, 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 deep pessimist about human nature.
Yeah.
And I think the first thing in order to exist on Earth is to accept the terrible truth about human beings, which is some of them are absolutely awful.
Mm.
And those who do evil, they have no doubts.
Mm-hmm.
They have no compunction. They do what they do because they want to survive. And therefore, the only way, because we can't, like Bugs Bunny, talk clever and escape, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The only way to sort the problem out, the only bulwark of defense that we have, is the rule of law and things, institutions, bodies like the United Nations. And the reason I wrote this book is because I see those institutions and the rule of law as being corroded, attacked, destroyed, undermined from below by the powerful. The world is, there have always been demagogues and tyrants, but at this time, the demagogues and the tyrants seem to be in the ascendant, telling their lies and indefatigably setting about destroying, undermining, demolishing the world order. The world order was always fragile.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the United Nations, as we know, is not a wonderful institution, but it's a hell of a lot better than no United Nations. Mm-hmm. So the book comes out of deep pessimism about Brexit, about the United States of America. You would hardly be surprised if you heard me say, I'm not really a supporter of Mr. Trump.
who is still here, right?
I think he may just have left.
Okay.
A few minutes ago.
Oh, I thought I felt my shoulders relax. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Suddenly Ireland is 247 pounds.
Well, but it's interesting because also the other thing that comes up a lot in your writing is a sense of compassion for the people who have done wrong, right? So in some ways, the support of this corrosion of these institutions, these structures, these theories, these ideas that we put into practice to try to help ourselves and keep some kind of compassion and order in the world, like, they get attacked when we say the person who's done wrong is an unforgivable monster, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking about this specifically, of course, in relation to The Wing Orderly's Tales, which is your book of short stories about prison in Northern Ireland. And you also taught in a prison,
yes,
right? And so so there's that balance. So, you know, so on the one hand, we need these structures because some people who are just, you know, they're just violent. They're just evil. They're out to get you. No excuse will get, you know. And then on the other hand, many of the people that we've cast away as evil deserve compassion.
I completely agree. Absolutely. Well, William Blake said, any man can hold one idea in his head, but the real achievement is to hold two conflicting ones at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
More. He didn't. That's what William Blake said, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
A great poet and a great artist. And I believe that that is the way we have to be. We have to be compassionate. And Crime and Punishment, you know, essentially we, especially in the West, in the neoliberal West, we buy into, we are convinced that, you know, we're all equal. And if you do wrong, you choose to. But the unfortunate truth, the unpalatable truth, the appalling truth, the rejected truth, is that free choice is in direct ratio to your socioeconomic condition.
Mm-hmm.
Poor people, literally, now talking like a 20-year-old and raising my finger, dear reader, dear listener, literally have less choice.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people don't like that, especially people who, you know, are of the hang'em, flog'em frame of mind, who believe building prisons and putting them in for longer and longer sentences works.
Right.
It doesn't work at all.
Yeah.
It's pointless.
So, you know, let me see if I can put these two things together, but I want to talk about the violence aspect and the brutality of these fables. So I'm thinking, you know, they're not like O. Henry stories. Like, the morals at the end aren't twists exactly. You know,
No. It's
not like, oh, here's the thing that you didn't see. In fact, what they often do, I think, is they mark the obvious. They mark something that actually, it's kind of in plain sight, but it startles you when you get to it, or me at least, it startles the reader because it's so stripped down. Like, it's like, I'm going to tell you the story, I'm going to give you this feeling, and then I'm going to distill it in a way that's stripped down. And the stripped downness is something that is shocking in a way. So I'm also thinking about, like, you have a radio drama which was based on a play, Charles and Mary.
Yes.
And sorry, I'm going to spoil it for everybody, but anyway, you can get it on Audible and listen to it. It's great. But the protagonist, Mary, at first people are, you know, making fun of her family, her mother specifically. There's something wrong with her. She's crazy. And you're like, God, her mother just seems like such an asshole. And then, as it turns out, she ends up stabbing her mother and threatening other people and stuff. So the thing is, like, there's this horror of finding out what you know is true, right? And I see that in these fables all the time. It's like, oh, there's actually nothing else here other than the obvious thing that you saw. And I'm going to jab you with it at the end in some way, you know?
Yes.
So there's that sort of, I'm also thinking of, you know, in Rosemary's Baby at the end where Mia Farrow finds out that, you know, everybody actually is a witch and satanic cult.
Yep.
That's the other baby. So the most absurd thing that was, it's not absurd at all. All the evidence was there. You just stopped yourself from believing it and stopped yourself from believing it. And then it's this moment of horror, which we think is revelation, but it's not. It's just what we knew all along.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about that too, where in these fables, there's a deluding of yourself until you get to the end and you're like, I should have just believed what I saw.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, one of my favorite stories is Oedipus.
Uh-huh.
And the point of Oedipus is that everyone tries to say, in particular Jocasta, let's just leave this alone. because the human capacity to delude oneself is infinite.
Mm.
What the fables are dealing with is our preference and need not to see the unpalatable fact of our idiocy, our insignificance, mm. or the malfeasance of the powers that be. We like to believe we're autonomous and safe and have agency. But what Aesop is describing time after time is that we avert our gaze from that truth, and then, you know, wham, we get slapped across the head and mm. we're forced to confront the truth. The other thing about these stories is the way that they were originally told and the way they're told here. Originally, in the accounts, in the Chambray edition, they're very summary.
Mm.
You know, they're sort of Olympian and detached. There's a wolf, there's a lamb, and the wolf comes up and says, I'm going to eat you because you've muddied the waters. There is reported speech, but not a great deal. And they work. But what I did when I was working on this was to say to myself, okay, if this was a film, what would I see?
Mm-hmm.
Or hear?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to see a little lamb. I'm going to see a wolf. The wolf is going to say this. The lamb is going to say that. Mm-hmm. A few shots here and there. And then I'm going to show what the wolf does, how he bites through the neck and kills.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like little films.
Mm.
And I've organized the material purposefully in order to get the image into the reader's head, having assumed from my understanding that that's what Aesop would have done, or a person working in the Aesopian tradition
mm.
in the early Hellenic period, tried to do the same thing here.
Yeah, I guess I would think maybe that the difference would be that a flat narrative, whether it was fairy tales or mythology or the fables, that there was a kind of, I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, that there was a two-dimensionality to the storytelling back then, because that's how people's consciousnesses were structured in a way. You know, even if you just look at artwork through the ages, you know, it's not until the 16th century or something where in Western artwork you start seeing perspective, right? Like suddenly the world popped out to people as dimensional in a way. But you can see that in these stories when you go back, there is a flatness to them. So
they're woodcuts.
Yes, exactly. And so for you, you know, the task, I suppose, was, okay, how do people hear these stories now? How does this work? So, yeah, it's the movie, not the woodcut, right? Mm. Yeah. I want to maybe, though, say also, because I was talking about the brutality and the smack in the face and all that kind of stuff, there's a story that is brutal, but I think also has a lot of kind of hope to it in a funny way, which is the story that takes its illustration is on the cover, which is The Frogs Who Demanded a King. It's one of my favorite ones, actually, so I'm glad you did it for the cover. But could you read that, please?
The Frogs Who Demanded a King. The frogs, having no king and living in anarchy, sent a delegate to Zeus. Please, great God, he said, appoint a king to rule over us. The delegate hopped away, and Zeus was left alone, fuming. Don't they understand that well-being and tranquility are found in the moderation of their own desires? Thought the great god? No, of course they don't. So then they come to me, and I have to sort their problem out. Lazy, good-for-nothing frogs. He went out onto the slopes of Olympus and selected a tree stump. This'll teach 'em, he said. There you go, frogs! Zeus shouted down. He hurled the stump towards the pond where they lived. It landed with a terrifying splash. The frogs were so frightened by the noise, they all hid under the banks. "There's a king for you," they heard Zeus shouting. "Enjoy!" Time passed. The frogs forgot their terror, crept from their hiding places, and swam up to their new king, floating in the middle of their pond. "What kind of a king is this?" said one. "A very big king," said a second. "And a very silent king," said a third. More time passed. The new king still hadn't said a word. Some of the bolder frogs decided to hop up onto him and get a better look. They clambered onto the stump, but still nothing was said. "This isn't a proper king," said one frog finally. "What kind of a king allows his subjects to sit on his head? No, 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 no. He won't do. Zeus will have to do better than this." They sent their delegate back to the great god. "Zeus," he said, "that king you sent us does absolutely nothing except bob about in our pond. Please send us a proper king who'll do what a proper king does and who won't let us sit on his head." "You want a proper king?" said Zeus. "All right, I'll give you a proper king if that's what you want." And he dispatched a water serpent who ate them all up. And the moral of the tale is, the deepest hole is the one you dug.
Well, I mean, I think there's so much in that fable, but I brought it up as a sort of instance of hope, not because the events of the story are hopeful, which they certainly aren't, but because that moral, unlike some of the others, it teaches a way to be, in a sense. Like, you know, there's this famous line from Jacques Lacan, the French psychoanalyst philosopher, who, you know, when the students in 1968 came to him and they said, "Well, what do you think about this revolution?" And he basically was like, "Well, you're not going to like my answer." And he said, "You don't want revolution, you just want new masters, you know." And, you know, it's like this idea of like, the frogs were wedded to their longing, you know? So it didn't matter what was put there. The only way to resolve it, in fact, was to kill them. Mm. And that was the king that they wanted. Like, the only way for them to get out of their own, like, cycle of longing was to be murdered by the snake. And it also is very funny that the snake acts in the exact same way that Zeus does. I mean, there's not really much, like, Zeus thinks he's being so wise and amazing in that, but, like, he's being as shitty as they are, you know? Yeah. So I'm just thinking about, like, that one presents in some ways like, okay, I'm going to show you who you are now, and maybe you can investigate your own desire so you're not just in your drive, which is that black hole that you just keep digging and digging and digging, you know?
When I was doing that, I thought, as I often do, of the old anarchist quote, "Whatever you vote, the government always wins."
Yeah.
And, yes, absolutely. We Lacan was absolutely correct. We just crave a master. You know, the students who rioted in 68 didn't want the Gaullist post-war French settlement. They wanted something a bit more Maoist or a bit more, I don't know, radical, as they saw it. And what did they get? Well, nothing really changed, did it?
Well, even had they gotten that Maoist, whatever, it wouldn't have been satisfying, right? Because if the idea is like, you know, I mean, it's called revolution for a reason. It's a spinning wheel, you know. I mean, not that I think that revolutionary politics are just out the window. Far be it for me to say that in front of somebody who is named after Karl Marx, by the way. But
I don't think revolution really works.
No, no. It's something else is needed, and I don't know exactly what to call it, but something else is needed. So
change only works if it's organic,
uh-huh,
and thoughtful, and underpinned by compromise and by consent.
It's so interesting you say that, because it's one of the things I noticed in Ireland. I was talking to a friend of mine who was saying, oh, we're so slow. Like, it took so long to, you know, come up with this abortion referendum and
the gay
marriage thing. And I was like, yeah, but you're slow, but it's real. You know, I mean, the slowness, although a lot of people are suffering in the meantime, means that the change can actually happen for real, because it's a change that happens in people's hearts, you know, and they're talking to their neighbors and having those kinds of conversations that don't rely on power like we did in the U.S. to change those things. And so they're constantly still, I mean, it's not as if they're not contested here, but constantly contested, and it's always precarious, you know, in a certain way. So I totally agree with you in that sense. But that's not revolution. That's something else, you know. That's a different way.
The outcome, when it arrives, eventually, is revolutionary.
Mm.
But it's not a revolution.
Right.
So in a country which was very, very... which had a constitution which closed off the possibility of there being anything such as the termination of a pregnancy, to remove the constitutional bar and then to change itself into a country where there were abortions, that's a revolution, or revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
But it does take time. And I think I've been thinking a lot recently, just because of what I've been reading about. Was listening to The Life of Ulysses S. Grant. And what strikes one as, he did two terms as the President of the United States, what strikes one as really, really interesting is that in the post-Civil War settlement farrago nightmare, the degree of pushback from the not just from states which had been in the Confederacy, but also states like Kentucky, which were not in the Confederacy, was they just weren't having it. And, you know, he sent soldiers in, he tried to control the Klan and other kinds of bodies. But eventually, he gave up. He had other things to do with the economy, he ran out of steam, whatever. And... you know, 100 years later, you have this, well, you know, the Civil War was kind of a sort of brother's war. How have we got to this? No, it wasn't. Don't be silly. But that's, you know, they tried to impose revolutionary, it was a revolutionary act. It was a Civil War, but also a revolutionary act to try to undo slavery and all the rest of it. And, what was required in order to get it, you know this better than me, in order to get it pushed through was so huge and humongous, they couldn't do it. And the result is that, you know, we now have a president who says things like, make America great.
Right, right.
And, you know, says things that he says about Charlottesville and all those other things. And you just go, what?
Yeah. It's something that's come up on the show a few times, and I think I need to talk about it at length more at some point. But I just always say, although I realize at first... blush, this sounds bad, but I always say, like, I'm totally against mythology. I'm against Carl Jung, Joseph Campbell, all these people that, like, really invest their time in mythology, because mythology is cyclical, circular. There's actually no escape, and it requires a repetition of certain kinds of archetypes and those sorts of things, which I think they have value. So I'm overstating the case. I think they have value. I think they can teach us things. But what I would like instead are for us to seek not revolution, which is mythological in some sense, but like real ruptures. So I call that the occult, like instead of mythology. Like I would like an occult intervention, like something that depends on the power of, you know, human beings to create something new out of art, out of thinking, out of ideology. And then like, sure, the wheel's going to keep turning. The mythology is going to keep going. But at a certain point, it starts to absorb and change as a result of those ruptures. So
I think, well, I mean, I've just been in New York. So I went and looked at a lot of art. And I went to the Stonewall exhibition in the Gray Museum. And I went down to the it's not called the Bowery Museum, but it's down there. Mm. And there was the work of a Jamaican artist who's now an American called Ward. Mm-hmm. And it's principally about police violence. Police, what the police do to black men. Incredible stuff. And he also makes art about, you know, suffering and what it is to be poor in America and what it is to be marginalized. But as I was looking with my wife at this stuff, I did find myself thinking, this must eventually, it's an outlier now. Well, actually, no, he's in a museum, so he's not a complete outlier. But this must eventually transform the way people, it will eventually produce your occult rupture. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you can't help but notice that all the notices, at least in New York, are in English and Spanish.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that's like, I mean, it's funny because I'm here talking about these occult ruptures and mythology, and here we're talking about Aesop. I mean, these really old stories that we have yet to absorb. But I mean, there's actually, yes, I have the page number for this one down, thankfully. There's one that I wanted you to read because it is really weird. Okay. It doesn't fit together properly in the way that some of the other ones do. You know, sometimes these morals are not, you know, they're not pat, you know?
No, you know what? All these morals, I redid all the morals.
Yes.
So I went to a dictionary of, there's a dictionary of racial quotations.
Huh.
Which was compiled in 1926 by nationality or tribe or ethnicity. And I plundered them and rewrote them. And those morals are... These sayings are vicious and have this kind of savage impudence. I'm going to tell you the truth. What is born a drum is beaten till death. For the real dead, we do not look in the graves. Uh-huh. Those sorts of observations.
And actually, that's one that's in here. What is born a drum is beaten till death.
Yes, yeah. It's a German one.
So what I'd love for you to read is The Flute-Playing Wolf and the Dancing Kid.
Yeah. Yes. The Flute-Playing Wolf and the Dancing Kid. The wolf closed in on the herd of goats. A kid who'd lagged and who knew he was done for turned and faced the wolf. "I know I'm finished," said the kid, "but before you devour me, will you play your flute for me and let me dance?" Seeing as he had his prey in his power, the wolf said, "Why not?" He played his flute, and the kid danced. A pack of huntsman's hounds, who had already heard the commotion made earlier by the herd of goats running away, now heard the flute. They came to investigate and surrounded the wolf and his prey. The wolf, knowing he was about to be harried and killed by the dogs, turned to the kid. "I've only myself to blame," he said. "The butcher should never think he's really an artist, should he? It's always going to end in tears." And the moral of the story is, in darkness, all things are black. Yes, that is a very brutal story about how we, well, like Samson, we pull the temple down on our heads. Mm. And also, what I like about this story is that it comes encoded with the idea of the haphazard or the entirely, well, it could be predicted if you thought about it, but it certainly isn't to be expected. So you think you have a simple situation where somebody who's strong is about to prey on somebody who's weak, and the weak says, can you grant me my last wish? And then someone even stronger and more ruthless comes along and catches you in the act and snuffs you out. It's a very, very pessimistic view of experience, but it's one that I think is true.
Well, and also, I mean, it's like, it's very complicated because the wolf's act of compassion... You know, is what ends up doing him in, right?
Yes.
But also the idea that the playing of music, like the flute. I mean, we just think of the most innocent, like the flute particularly is like, an, in some ways, an innocent, playful sounding, maybe not innocent, but very playful sounding instrument, you know? But then, you know, you're like, okay, but that's also, who's the goat that plays the flute? Well, it's Pan or, you know, the satyr or whatever, you know? And that person's always trouble, you know? For anybody, you know, it could be good trouble, exciting trouble, but that person's always trouble and they've always got one up on you as well, you know?
Yes.
And so there's so much packed in there. And then this bizarre that you put at the end, I suppose you brought this to it as well, this moral, in darkness all things are black, you know. I think that there's so much in there, and I like it because I think it's just like you said, it appears to be simple, but in fact, you know, you begin to see even the simplest things. Okay, yes, dogs kill wolves, wolves kill goats, you know, there's a tremendous complexity and potentiality and opportunity for different pathways.
There, absolutely.
You know,
in the world, in the kind of social ecology, there are so many different possibilities. The other thing about these stories and the way in which, and their brevity and their shortness is, which I think has been underscored or demonstrated by this conversation, they are also like kind of meditative texts, or texts which little parables that you can go, oh, that's yes, because they're so short, you can hold all the information, you can hold the entire thing in your head. You've got all the characters, you've got all the dialogue, you've got the whole thing, and then you can look at it like holding a jewel in your hand, and you can go, oh, yes, I can look at it this way. Oh, yes, I can look at it that way, and that then in turn leads to the intelligence going, you know, one thing leading to another. They are designed to provoke thought.
Yeah, and I like
speculation.
That relates then back also to the sort of multi-availability that they had for Aesop, who could change them for different situations. You know, like, I'll turn it this way for this situation, or this way for this. And, I mean, I think with this one in particular, there's just this sort of like, I'm thinking of this, you know, American comedian guy who has kind of gone off the rails, unfortunately, this guy, Penn Jillette, Penn and Teller, do you know this musician? I mean, a magician.
Yes, there used to be the Penn and Teller show on television, on Channel 4.
Yes, so he's sort of become like a little bit conservative-y, like a little, you know.
Both of them?
No, just Penn. Okay.
Now, is Penn the one who talks or the one who doesn't talk?
Penn's the one who talks, right?
He's with long hair.
Yes, yes.
So, and he's gone right wing.
Well, I wouldn't take it that far, yes, but just the sort of slightly objectionable. But he told this story, which I think is great, about he got, when he was younger, he was walking home with like a milkshake. And now the milkshake has a big presence on the world stage right now, which I love. But he was carrying a milkshake and a bunch of kids who didn't like him showed up and they surrounded him. And they said that they were going to kick his ass. And he was just, you know, kind of a weakling kid, like a lot of us are, you know, were. And so he was just like, and he took the lid off the milkshake and just poured it on his head. And they all kind of laughed and then they left him alone, you know? And so that's how I see this. It's like, you never know what amulet you'll have, you know? It's like, be daring. Well, can I just play the flute for a second here before you kill me? You know,
well, can you play the flute for a second before you kill me?
Yeah, right.
It's the wolf who plays the flute.
Oh, right, exactly.
It's
the
kid who dances.
Yes. Oh, I totally missed that, actually. That's so funny. My mind was so programmed to think of the goat playing the flute.
No,
that
the goat dances. But it doesn't matter.
Funny. Yeah. No, it doesn't. You're right. And, I mean, it matters to be true to the story. But, yes, you're right. It doesn't. It ultimately doesn't matter. But I'm just thinking, there's also this great Dennis Johnson essay about him traveling through and meeting up with some paramilitaries, and I'm going to forget the country, but it was a country in Africa. It's in his book, Seek, his book of essays. And these men with guns stop him, and he's like, I didn't know what to do, so I threw on like my journalist credentials over my neck, even though they already knew I was a journalist. And I just thought, like, this is an amulet. This will protect me. And somehow after he did that, the act of doing it, they kind of backed off and let him go through. But not because he had the credentials. They already knew he was a journalist. Mm-hmm. It was somehow this weird, absurd moment. And so that's like can you just do something that maybe you can't even imagine how it would work? And maybe that can change the situation that we're in. Mm. Because I think it was so much incremental change. It's just such, in some ways, also just bullshit. Like, do something bizarre, I think, sometimes might be the way out, you know?
I think, well, the Penn story is perfect.
Yeah.
I absolutely believe that. There's also, if you look at it, you know, in Pinter writes, Harold Pinter, the playwright and Nobel laureate, he has these extraordinary accounts of being harassed by fascists in, because there was, you know, quite a lot of English fascists around in the kind of just after the war, and the ability to keep talking. You kept talking. You kept saying something. You elicited a response. You gave them back a response. It was tennis. Ping, pong, ping, pong, and that kept you alive. And what you would come up with would be completely, you weren't saying to them, you know, it's wrong to be a fascist.
Yeah.
You didn't do anything like that. Derren Brown.
It would sound like a Pinter play, actually.
Yeah. Derren, well, exactly. Derren Brown, the magician, the mentalist. I'm not quite certain what he is, but you'll have to explain to your American listenership.
I'll put it in the show notes here.
Yeah. So Derren Brown talks about how to defend oneself against thugs, and his argument, because he's often been out late at night, is that you engage them in complex mathematical conversation that makes them think. So he says, you say something like to them, okay, so if I'm 5 foot and I can jump 2 foot, will I be able to get over that 10 foot wall? And then they sort of go, No, sorry, no, it's not a 10-foot wall. It's an 11-foot wall. Okay, now I can only jump up 2 foot. So, wait a second, 9 feet, that's 7 foot, so I'm 4 foot shorter. How much more energy do... And it's nonsense. But you make people engage and they start thinking, as opposed to showing your fear, although you are terrified, or telling them, you know, giving them the moral line, go away, stop being in my face or whatever, which doesn't work with bullies. Just encourages.
So one more comment, then I want to end with one fable, and then we'll be done. But I, you know, something I bring up all the time is like the way to affect real political change is that, again, Bugs Bunny, maybe you can't talk yourself out of it sometimes. So maybe Darren Brown's thing doesn't work all the time, right? Like, you know, when we imagine Gandhi saying to Hitler, well, we just passively resisted, you know, like we kind of laugh at that because we think, no, this was a different force, you know, it might have had a different, I mean, who knows, actually, it may have worked or may not. But when I think of Bugs Bunny being chased down the alleyway, and he gets stuck and there's a brick wall there and there's nowhere for him to go. So he pulls out a piece of chalk and draws a door and then opens the door and walks through, right?
Yeah.
That's like my political idea is like, no, like there's, and what's beyond that door is also just a mind-bending question. You know, how does this work? Like do something as close to impossible as you can, you know.
When you're in trouble.
Yes. And we're all in trouble now.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But the Hitler thing is, Hitler is interesting because, well, he assumed power because Hindenburg thought, okay, he hasn't won the election. He's got the most seats. We can let him in. He can form a minority government. I can control him. It was hubris. Mm-hmm. It was overreach on the part of the old sclerotic Persian, not Persian, what am I talking about? Prussian oligarch.
What a slip, yeah, Carlo. Yeah. Yeah.
No, Persians will never do something like
that. I'm leaving the fluff in.
Leave all fluff away. And so in other words, totalitarianism really... it was always there, but a fatal misjudgment by the ruling classes allowed it in. Populism always involves an alliance between the elite and the atavistic and the nationalistic.
Hmm.
And it's always an uneasy alliance, but it sort of works. Farage or Trump, all these people who are running our lives now. Boris Johnson, who tell us that they are people of the people, are in fact not people of the people. They are not the people. They are rich, entitled, etc., etc., etc. So Hitler and the ruling elite in Germany, that was the kind of alliance between the top and the bottom that's been run, that has run through history. But the top made a fatal misjudgment. The communists not making common cause with the socialists didn't help. I mean, that's another problem, you know. Those who just want something pure and perfect their way or the highway, yeah, that doesn't work either.
Yeah. All right, let me just do the last one. I just want to close with a note of cruel, what I would call cruel hope.
Cruel hope.
Well. Yes. It's not exactly, and this is, I think, my favorite in the whole book.
Oh, right.
Okay, so it's 69, not just for that number, but is The Fox and the Farmer.
Now, it's very interesting that you've chosen The Fox and the Farmer, because I would say I had to do a reading the other night, and it was with this that I opened, because it is, I mean, of course, I love all my children equally. You know, I don't have a favorite, but it's one of my favorites.
Oh, great.
69. The Fox and the Farmer. One night, a fox went to a farm and killed every bird in the henhouse. When the farmer came out in the morning and saw the carnage, he was incensed. "Mr. Fox," he vowed, "I'll pay you back for what you've done." He set a trap and caught the fox alive. "Right," said the farmer, "I promised I would pay you back, and I'm a man of my word." He tied a rope soaked in oil to the fox's tail. Then he set the rope alight and released the fox on the track in front of his farmhouse. The fox ran about, trailing the burning rope, yelping and screaming as the flames spread up his tail. "Hey, stupid, your tail's on fire," the farmer shouted. It was great sport watching the fox running about in a frenzy, trying to escape the flames it could never escape. But then, crazed and panic-stricken, the fox left the track and bolted towards the field where the farmer's wheat crop, tall and lovely and dry, stood ready and waiting to be harvested. "Hey, no, not that way," the farmer bellowed. The farmer ran his fastest, but his fastest wasn't fast enough to catch the fox before it got right into the middle of the field and set the crop alight. The flames spread, and the whole field became a burning, raging conflagration. The farmer stood on the edge and watched. He felt the heat of the flames on his face and smelled the familiar smell of burning straw. It made his eyes sting and his throat hurt. "What will my children eat if we have no bread?" he said. But there was no one there to hear him, let alone answer. And the moral of the tale is, do not lift the club too high. It may fall on your head.
It's a great place to end.
Great. I didn't read the first one as well, but...
That's all right. But thank you. Thank you so much for hanging out and talking.
You can live with fluffs.
I can live with fluffs. Okay. So everybody, thank you so much for listening. And thanks for being here, Carlo.
Pleasure.